Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode one of the White Trash Genius podcast. I am the White Trash Genius, your host, Nick Green, and I think we should take care of a couple housekeeping things. Number one, isn't it kind of arrogant to call yourself a genius? Yeah, it would be if I weren't being totally sarcastic. I'm not a genius. White Trash Genius is a nickname my friends back home gave me when we were kids. They didn't give it to me because I'm a genius. They gave it to me because I'm an idiot. I'm an idiot, you know? But I'm pretty smart for a dropout retard fuck-up who grew up in a house that a lot of the time didn't have running water or electricity. You know, when it comes to dudes with an 8th grade education, yeah, I'm smarter than 6 or 7 out of 10 of them. So no, I'm not a genius, okay? I'm a moron. It's a nickname. And like all nicknames, it satisfies two basic criteria. The first is that it's kinda mean, right? Nobody calls me a white trash genius to be nice. It's a friendly sorta shit-talking thing. Like, there are at least two insults buried in the subtext of that moniker. Number one, I'm trash. I'm garbage. And yeah, I'm brilliant. As far as total fucking dummies go. You know? And the second condition that this nickname and all nicknames have to satisfy if they're to be legitimate is this. You can't give it to yourself. You can't give yourself a nickname. You ever meet somebody who tried to do that? Like a friend when you were kids, tried to give themselves a nickname? Comes up to you guys one day, he's like, yeah, guys, I'm going by Stealth now. So just call me Stealth from here on out. It's like, no, bitch, you're not Stealth, okay? You're not badass. Nobody calls you that. Your name's Stefan, okay? Stefan, not Stealth, you dope. So, okay. Now we know what the show's called and why it's called what it's called. But what is the show? That's simple. This is a show for stories and storytelling. Fiction, non-fiction, doesn't matter. I'm a writer, and I want to get my work out there. Problem. Nobody's publishing me. I've tried, and I failed. And maybe that's because I suck, okay? I'm cognizant of that possibility. I might just not be any good at this. Maybe that's it. But I am sick and tired of submitting some short story that I busted my ass on to like 30 magazines and journals, only to have every single one of them send me some stupid form letter back telling me, basically, to fuck my own face. And, like, you have to pay a submission fee most of the time to these magazines, to these journals. And it's bullshit. It's a total scam, you know? I've worked on some of these rags as, like, a slush reader, and I was talking to a colleague. I asked her, how do you get all the reading done when you're busy with class and finals and teaching and whatever else? And you know what she said to me? She said, easy. You don't. You just don't do it. Just reject a giant stack at a time. It's their fault for overworking us. That's what she told me. And I was shocked when I heard this. As an artist, how could you conceivably be so shitty to other artists? But that's what she does. Just flat out rejects a whole stack of manuscripts without so much as reading them to see if they're a good fit for the magazine. Isn't that ridiculous? It makes me wonder, how often does this happen? She says she's not the only one. Was trying to talk me into doing it this way to make my life easier. So, let me get this straight. I'm supposed to spend 10 hours writing, rewriting, and polishing a short story. That's what it takes, by the way. Like 10 hours minimum to have something decent and readable on your hands. And I'm going to put in all that work to have some mindless, selfish sack of trash turn it down without even reading it. No. No way. Then you see the stuff these publications are putting out, and it's like, really? This is the shit you couldn't pass up? It's the same trash over and over and over. Some thinly veiled hit piece on the president. Guys, nobody cares. Stop writing about politics. It's exhausting. Speaking of, if you're a writer, or if you're just an interesting dude or chick, and you want to come on the show, drop me a line, and I'll have you on. You can read, or we can talk, and we'll do like a Q&A kind of conversation thing after. It's going to be great. It's going to be like Joe Rogan, only shittier. So, yeah, this podcast exists as a way for me to reach people who like a good story. And I don't want to play the game anymore. The gatekeeper game, where I try and try and try to get published by some small magazine that maybe 30 people will ever read. It's nonsense. It's a waste of time and money. Like, my whole life, I've never liked the idea of needing permission. Having to ask, can I do this? Like, I want to do this thing. Can I do it? That has always rubbed me the wrong way. Like, fuck you. I do what I want. Alright? I don't need your permission. I don't need you to tell me that I'm good enough. I do not need that validation. You know, I dropped out when I was 15. Last grade I finished was 8th. I've been arrested. I weighed over 300 pounds at one point. And none of that stopped me from doing all the things that I wanted to do. None of that stopped me from becoming a United States Marine, from graduating college with high honors in 2.5 years instead of 4, from teaching, from pursuing my master's degree, from running ultra marathons. All the doors have always been closed. This isn't new. And I've always ripped all the doors off the hinges. That's what this is about. It's about recognizing that a way forward does not exist. Okay? All the doors are closed. Same as they've ever been. It's about taking that recognition and instead of crying, instead of bitching, sour grapes, all that, instead, I'm just going to make my own path. You won't give? Fine. I'll take. So, that's it. That's me. That's the show. That's what it's about. And with all of that out of the way, we can start telling stories. The first story that I'm going to read on this show is called The Elk Calf, and I hope you dig it. Please feel free to email questions or comments after the show, and I'll respond to them at the start of the next episode. All right, enjoy. The Elk Calf. My whole life, I've never caught one break. Shit luck all the way back to kindergarten. That's old news. This morning, I won tickets to Game 7 of the World Series. First pitch, 7:40, Central. Game 7, the greatest sports spectacle on earth. A once-in-a-lifetime shot to see it all go down in person and in color. Braves and Twins for the 1991 crown. Games in Minneapolis. But I'm not headed to Minneapolis. Instead, I'm barreling down I-35 West, juiced to the tits on black coffee. Sun's setting, painting the road ahead of me in pink and gold. Been driving 2 hours, so I figure I got 15 more to look forward to. I don't speed. I'm gunning for an office party in Logan, Utah. The office isn't mine. Neither is the party. None of that matters. Catherine Beck. This firecracker. bouncy red hair, bottomless green eyes like round emeralds. The party's hers. Some kind of departmental thing her grad school is putting on in the cafeteria. Music, dancing, veggie trays and shit. I wouldn't miss it. Not for all the tea in China. Not for all North Carolina. I don't know Catherine. Not really, but maybe I love her. I'm Joe Maris. I live in New Ulm, which is the county seat of Brown County. It's always cold in Brown. I mean, it's always cold. You don't know cold like we know cold. Gets to be where you think cold is normal. Warm catches you flat-footed. Brown County folks are nice, though, and I don't dig on sunburns too much. I've never left Minnesota. I've hardly been outside of New Ulm. Why would I leave? We've got all I need. A Walmart, two diners, a pizza joint called Fatty's. There's a gun shop and an indoor range where a sort of attractive counter girl shows me this Remington and that Colt. She pretends to flirt with me. I pretend to not know she gets paid a commission for sales. It's a fun dance. There's a bowling alley that ain't half bad when they oil the lanes, a service the proprietors provide once a week on Mondays, which is also dollar bowling night. So, okay, it ain't the Jersey Shore, but it's mine. Tomorrow's my 25th birthday. It'll be the 300th day of 1991. Kinda neat. With all this stuff landing in my lap, tickets, the chance to be Catherine Beck's date, the whole birthday business, kinda slipped my mind. How I came to get the tickets to the biggest game in Minnesota sports history was a radio contest. Happened like this. Linda, the station's call screener, picked up and told me I was the lucky 13th caller. Now, you understand that these are tickets for Game 7. Should the game be necessary, right? She asked. Right, I said. I knew the Twins would win Game 6, force a 7th game. I could feel it, like the promise of rain in the air on a cool gray day. I knew something else, too. The answer to the only question that mattered. The question was this. Who is the only player to lead baseball in home runs without hitting a ball over the fence all season long? I turned the question over in my head. It made no sense. I asked the jock to repeat it. He did. His words, industrial, harsh, impatient. A sticky, nervous film formed over my forehead. Slime, not sweat. Calling had been a mistake. My brain microwaved itself. I did not know the answer. I was wrong. Stupid. Wrong. Stupid. Hang up, Joe. Hang up. Just end this call. End this conversation. Ty Cobb, I said. Sparks flew. Neurons fired. Synaptic receptors did whatever it is they do. The words were out before I knew I was saying them, or why. The response was automatic. But I knew once I'd answered that I was right. Ty Cobb hit more home runs than anyone in baseball in 1909, and he did it without hitting a ball over the fence. It was just something I had known for so long I'd forgotten where I'd picked it up. Cobb's long balls that year were all inside the park. He ran them out. Speed over power. I was right. I knew it. The line went dead quiet, stayed that way for a century. Presidents came and went. Wars were fought and won. Old Glory waved. Generations of Americans got married and bought homes and had children and died of heart disease. Then the jock spoke. Oh, yowza! That is not the correct answer. My ears burned red hot. Stupid tears formed in the corners of my eyes. I was 12 years old again, searching for words to explain to my mother the stash of Hustler magazine she'd found under my bed. I decided I was going to throw the phone at the wall. I visualized chucking it, the stupid thing exploding against the sheetrock, breaking up into 6 or 7 ugly plastic splinters. I was just about to let it rip when sound poured out of the handset. "Just jerking your chain! Congratulations, son!" the jock roared. "Stay on the phone! Linda is going to get your information and enjoy those free tickets. Woo! Ty Cobb, ladies and gents. And good on that young man for knowing his history. I say, a yowza!" "Tomorrow's my birthday," I said. "Why?" Shit, nothing else made sense. But I was already off the air. Elevator music kept my ears busy until Linda came back on. When she did, she told me to pick up my tickets at the station the next day if the game was to be played, if Atlanta lost. And they did lose. The Twins forced a Game 7 in Minneapolis just the way I knew they would. I still can't believe I won tickets, or that they now lay unclaimed at KFAN. My buddies at work down at the pawn shop will never let me live that one down. They couldn't understand that those tickets will go unused in the service of some greater good. They'd never believe that a 17-hour road trip to Logan, Utah was a better offer than free tickets to Game 7. But then they never saw Catherine Beck light up an undergraduate C-fiction seminar like Nagasaki in 45 either. I'm going out to Logan. That's all there is to it. Chance like this just don't come along often. When it does, you gotta grab it by the throat. After I won tickets, I went to Fatty's Pizzeria. I'm supposed to be on a diet, the low-carb thing, but this was special. This was cause for celebration. I called in my favorite, a large pineapple and pepperoni thin crust pie with extra cheese, what I always called a redneck Hawaiian. I'm waiting for them to finish cooking it up, and in walks Bethany Collins. Bethany went to college with me. I met her in that C-fiction class. She sat next to Catherine Beck. They were friends. There in Fatty's, my luck having turned once and for all, I asked Bethany for Catherine's number. She gave it to me. No hesitation. Bethany had been inconsiderate of Catherine's privacy to cough it right up like that. Rude, really. But that's what she did. It's about like anything else, I guess. Doesn't make much sense. It's as if everything were held together by nothing. Built on sand. It's just people being drunk or stupid, or drunk and stupid, and selfish, and horny and careless, but kind. Mostly, people are kind. And that's what this was. I rolled 2 stop signs, kept my truck moving all the way home. The redneck Hawaiian got cold. Grease soaked through the cardboard box all over my green particle board kitchen counter. I had more pressing business, talking to Catherine Beck, long distance. I got her on the line on the first try, on the first ring. She must have been standing right there by the phone. Fate. She remembered me, thank God. The conversation came easy. We talked and talked, mostly about nothing. Then she mentioned this office party for her graduate school's English department out in Logan. Said she was going stag. "My ass you are," I said. "I'll take you." "Joe, if you can make it to Utah, you can be my date," Catherine said. That little laugh told me she was half kidding, but only half. "I'll make it. I'm sure I can," I told her. Already I was doing math, trying to figure whether or not I'd overdraft my bank account buying gas. "Come then," she said. I did not need to be told twice. I packed a shirt and tie, a bottle of cologne, a toothbrush, and a half-gallon milk jug full of black coffee. Gassed up, 26 minutes after I hung up the phone, I was on the road without a thought of those tickets. God damn the twins to hell. Sun's down now. Sky is made of amethyst, jagged purple rock. Shreds of white cloud here and there. Highways clearing out. Just me and the truckers for the most part. They run 5 or 10 below the limit. I slip in and out of the center lane, passing them. I wonder where they're headed, what they're hauling, how they sleep in those rigs, if they miss their families. I wonder if they know. If they know, I'm on the way to the rest of my life, to my dream girl. I wonder if they're jealous, or if they're rooting for me. I like to think they're rooting for me. Windows are down. Heater core shit the bed last year. It's $1,000 fix. All labor. The dash has to come out. I can't do the work myself. Who the fuck has an extra grand laying around? Not this pilgrim. If I run the AC or the heat, aerosolized antifreeze passes into the cabin through the vents in a sweet, poisonous fog. Shit'll kill you. An icy wind whistles around in the cab of my truck. Cold. Caffeinated. Good. I could drive from now till rapture. The power steering pump whines as I pass a semi with Oregon plates. I tilt my face to the driver of the rig. He nods. I nod, and I slide into the night. The crumbling mechanical state of my Ford is a constant reminder that, degree in hand, I'm still broke. After slime-dogging my way through high school, barely graduating at the bottom of my class, I did what my parents and teachers always told me I should do. I went to college, got a worthless degree from a worthless university, double major, English and anthropology. I am not working in my fields. Neither's almost anyone else I know. We're all singers, photographers, historians, and goddamn anthropologist writers trying to force-fit ourselves into lives as car salesmen, waitresses, gas station clerks, and landscapers. Me, I'm a pawnbroker. It's not bad work, something new every day. Crackheads trying to get a $4 loan on a stolen toaster, whatever. It ain't boring. But it ain't what I'm supposed to be doing either. The fit's lousy. What would you expect? It's like trying to mow grass with a scalpel. Gotta be 10 below zero in this truck. Fucking heater core. 5 hours in, 12 to go. A sphinx moth flies in through my window, hits me in the forehead. He does not splat. He clunks. Bugs are tough. We're lucky they aren't big. They'd rule the world. The little moth flops into my lap. Dead man's float. He shakes his ass, whips his wings back and forth in a mad fury, flips himself over. He looks around, decides my lap isn't his jam, flies right back out the window. Bye, friend. Snot freezes in my nose. Ice boogers. The night chill and my milk jug full of black coffee keep me between the lines. I'm hanging in at 65 miles an hour. I'm hungry and lean. I'm cold and nervous and young and full of hope. My best self. So, what's the deal with this Catherine Beck? What she got's worth driving 34 hours round trip for? Fair questions. All I can tell you is this. She's got beautiful guts. I could spin up some more, but it'd just be bullshit. Beauty. Guts. Guts that are themselves beautiful. Brother, there ain't nothing like it. I heard a story about her once. Some guy copped a feel in the hall when she was in high school. I wasn't there, didn't even know she existed yet. I only heard about it years later, when we were in college. Anyway, this guy reached up her skirt and grabbed at her ass. So she spins around and elbows him in the face. Didn't knee him in the crotch, didn't gasp and slap him, elbowed him right in the mouth. Every time I heard that story, it got bloodier, more preposterous. Eventually, I heard a version that had the guy losing teeth and requiring reconstructive surgery. But, like I said, guts. Beautiful guts. She took no shit in that C-fiction class we had together either. She'd shut you down, tell you if she thought your analysis of the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner was fucked up. I loved that. I do still. I never knew her, but I always wanted to. She had a boyfriend when we were in college, George some shit. Brought him into class one day. Didn't seem like nothing special to me, but they acted sorta happy. I was sure it'd break off, so I plotted. Loomed and waited like an ambush predator deep in the jungle. Waited for Georgie boy to fuck up just once. And when he did, I would be quick and carnivorous and lethal. But he didn't. He never did. The semester ended. We never had another class together. It ate me alive for a while. And then I forgot all about Catherine Beck. About George some shit. About never taking my shot. It all burned off. Except it didn't. Not all the time. Now and then, her petite figure wove its way into my dreams. Dreams that seemed to come more often on nights I ate canned tuna than not. Why, I can't pretend to know. We're not rational creatures. Not really. She'd visit me in my sleep, her lips plump and red, looking like they wanted to be kissed. And she'd say this. Pussy. That's what I was. For never asking her out, for never going for it. I was a big, fat pussy, and I'd rather die 100,000 deaths. Time blew by. Other women came and went. They brought with them no answers. They left questions behind, along with their discarded hair ties that had turned up in my sheets weeks after they were gone. Their lavender body lotion in my bathroom, their Danielle Steele novels on my nightstand. Nobody cared. Least of all me. I worked harder and got older and maybe a little less stupid too, but probably not. I switch on the radio and find the game, the one I'm supposed to be at. No score in the sixth. John Gordon, the voice of the Twins, reports a sold-out crowd of 55,883. Might even be true if I weren't freezing my balls off in this truck on the way to Logan. I listen for a while, but nothing's happening. Midnight now. Happy birthday, Joe Maris, you lucky son of a bitch. I imagine telling my kids, our kids, mine and Catherine's, about all this one day. About the time I drove 34 hours round trip to be with your mom at her grad school's autumn office get-together. That's how I got the best woman who ever lived to be my wife, kids, I'll say. And that's why you gotta take your shots. I say, never play it safe. Fear is of no utility to you. Live hard. Get fired. Lose everything. Bet the house. Try. Fail. That's what living is. I'll turn it into a father's lesson, all didactic and shit. Why not? Motherfuck! I guess I zigged when I should have zagged. Cost myself at least an hour. I'm doubling back through the eastern edge of Idaho, a state I should have never even crossed into. Now it's a six-state trek. Fine. I'm working my way through a maze of maize. Corn and nothing else. Well, maybe it's not corn. I can't tell in this light. I'm not a farmer. It's a monocrop and it's everywhere. I guess this is Idaho, what it's all about. Not bad. At the party, Catherine's gonna be gorgeous. My tie will match her dress, even though I forgot to ask her which color she'd chosen. Forest green, it is written. She'll be in a forest green dress that matches my forest green tie. I think of her legs, her skinny pale ankles running into calves and up to sculpted thighs, and god damn, I'm trying not to get ahead of myself. I'm trying to manage my excitement. But it's so easy to get ahead of myself, ahead of everything. Here in my little truck, only a half a night's drive from everything that could be, I'm in front of it all. I'll take Catherine camping. Maybe she's never been. I'll build her a fire, make her soup. I'll cheat, of course. I'll put one of those GI Vietnam-era compressed trioxane fuel tablets at the base of my fire to be sure it stays lit. Flames will rise and keep on rising. She'll never know. She might not even finish her soup before we bail into the pop-up tent I got for my 16th birthday. Easy killer. Sip. Thin shards of ice slosh around in my jug of black coffee. It's getting empty. I pull over. I smell barley. It's barley all over Idaho. I unzip, leak out under the stars. Here, my cock in my hand, nothing and no one in sight, I know that I am a man. A noble savage. I am pissing in the tradition of 1,000 generations of nomadic hunter-gatherers. Those hardened, pre-sedentary humans and me, we're the same. We're undomesticated, ungovernable. My piss stinks like Folgers. I zip up, stare. No moon, full dark. More stars than you could count in 2 lifetimes. I stare and I wonder if Catherine is the sort of woman who would want a spring for heated tiles in the bathroom of her home. The road grins at me as I cross into Utah. I straighten myself up. My abdominal muscles bunch. My heart jumps around under my coat. I still have a way to go, but I'm at least in the right state. I can smell Catherine's perfume. Peaches. She'll introduce me as her boyfriend in 2 months, as her fiancé in 6, and as her husband in 1 year's time. I wonder if she'll want to be married in a church or outdoors. Not in a church. It's too stuffy. More rustic, I decide. Outdoors. Somewhere quiet out in the country, maybe on a farm. Her dress, the ring I'll save up for her. It's all dripping in light as she walks up the dirt path to the makeshift altar. The Rolling Stones tape I've been listening to on repeat all night hangs up on Gimme Shelter. The hook, rape, murder, then screeching wheels in the tape deck, then the chorus again. Rape, murder, wheels clicking. I hit eject. Nothing happens. I hit eject again and again. More screeching, clicking wheels. Rape, murder. I smack the tape deck hard with the back of my hand. The rest of the hook spills out. It's just a shot away. It's just... everything crashes together. The road and the tape deck and my dash and the brown mass standing broadside in the middle of the road all fall into one composite image, a single, dry, ugly color. Metal crunches, glass splits. My heart drops into my asshole. This is what dying feels like. The top of my head smashes into the roof. I mash the brakes hard. Pump, pump, pump. The bed fishtails behind me, left, then right. I go from 60 to 0 in 2 seconds flat. I stop in tall, dead grass. Breathe. My heart rises out of my ass, through my stomach, comes to a stop in its tiny compartment in my chest. It sounds like it's gonna rip out of my flannel. Cold coffee's everywhere, all over everything. Wheels screech, clicking in the tape deck. I kill the motor. I thank Christ I put my seatbelt on after that piss back in Idaho. Pictures flood my thoughts. Flashes, still images, a tangle of hooves and hide. I unbuckle and force the driver's side door open. It needs a good shove. I feel stiffness give way in my neck and legs. I step down out of my truck, out into the world. I walk over to this motionless heap of meat on the roadside. It's a little elk. It makes a hoarse noise as I draw near. He looks up at me with eyes like black gumballs. Those eyes seem to ask, "Joe, is that you? Joe, will I never get to be a bull?" His legs are smashed to shit. Shards of white bone like spears poke through his fur. Blood drips from the shattered appendages, hissing and popping like hot grease as it falls to the ground. The blood looks black in the moonlight. It pools and freezes right away like a gory snow cone. Panic hits me like a bag full of hammers. I've got to make this office party. I've got to get back on the road. There's no time for this shit. I pray to Jesus and Muhammad and anybody else who'll listen that I can still make it to Logan. I jog back, jump in, slam the door shut behind me. I turn the key, sputter. Again, sputter. I punch the gas, hit it one more time. Vroom! I put it in gear and pray I can limp to Logan. I make it all of 10 feet before the motor stalls out. Fuck! I turn it over again. Vroom! I stare into the rearview mirror. My own beaten, windburned face looks back at me. I'm a fool. I understand everything. I'm not gonna make it. I never was. This unfortunate creature just happened to be what stopped me. I wasn't on my way to Catherine back in the rest of my life. Might as well be no Catherine back. I don't know her, and I never will. It was leading here, to this place, all along. I throw it in park, kill the engine, get out. I walk back, kneel down beside the calf. He's beyond saving, not that there's an open animal hospital nearby. He's gonna die here on this stretch of arid road. It ain't his fault. Ain't mine either, just the way it is. If there's reincarnation, next time maybe he won't be born an elk. Maybe I won't be reborn a luckless loser. Maybe. I fetch a green army surplus blanket from my truck's toolbox. Scratchy, but it's wool and warm. Black letters are painted on each side in block font. U.S., it reads. I walk around to the passenger side door, snatch my .45 from the glove compartment, not to use on the calf. I don't want to put him out of his misery. I've done enough damage for one night. I only grab the pistol in case of coyotes. They can smell blood in the air 2 miles away, my grandpa said when he was alive. The poor creature isn't going to be ripped apart by feral dogs while he's still breathing, not tonight. I'm not some hero either. I'm not selfless. I'm busted up. Finished. Beat. That's all. The elk shows no fear of me as I drape the blanket over his broken body. Too fucked up to fuss, maybe. I choose to believe that he knows I mean him no harm. I choose to believe that. False dawn. I'm sitting Indian style on the roadside. Haven't seen a single car. Utah. Go figure. The calf rests his head in my lap. I'm petting his nose. I look up. Two lemon-yellow orbs glow in the pre-dawn haze. Eyes bouncing, unblinking. The coyote comes to within 100 or so feet of where I'm sitting with the calf who's clung to life all through the night. He's breathed deep all the while, puffs of vapor darting from his nose, steady. The coyote creeps nearer and nearer. I can see his silhouette now, mangy, thin. Winter already has taken its toll. I jerk the 45 from my blue jeans and sweep off its safety with my right thumb. I get a solid sight picture, aiming at the space between the two glowing balls of light as they edge closer and closer. I lead the animal a little, accounting for his pace on approach. I apply slow, firm pressure. I pull straight back and to the rear, find the trigger's back wall. Easy. Just a little more pressure. The slug zips off the rocky floor, cracks against something in the distance. The small wolf doesn't move. He just stares back at me. He's eye-fucking me, daring me to shoot again. I don't shoot, don't want to, and he doesn't move. We just stare at each other. He turns and trots off with no urgency. I watch the skinny thing disappear into the early morning desert. I'm kinda glad the shot missed. I tried my best to make it, but it missed. For whatever reason, that feels right. I shove the 45 back into my bloody jeans, slide my hand over to stroke the top of the elk's head, and he's gone. The shot scared the rest of the life out of him. His projecting face is tilted up toward the stars overhead. White specks reflect in the black bulbs of his eyes like a miniature universe full of galaxies and star systems and planets and lives all trapped inside, praying to get out, praying to bits. I lift his dead skull from my lap, stand up. Stiffness gives way again. Everything cracks. My jeans are soaked through in frozen elk's blood. I walk back to my busted truck. I turn just once to look at the dead calf, and there's four pairs of lemon-yellow eyes moving in. Breakfast. Fair enough. I slip the key into the ignition, pause, take off my gun, and crank it. Stereo burps to life. My thumbs drum to the beat all on their own. The morning's long and bright. Highway keeps coming at me. And I can't help but wonder what it might have been like to be a bull.